Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good Friday afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. In the valley forecast for the rest of this afternoon, look for partly sunny skies with a high of 60. Partly cloudy skies tonight with overnight lows in the mid-40s. Sunny and 68 tomorrow. Same goes for Sunday. Sunny and 67 for the start of next work week on Monday. Right now in Phoenix, under partly cloudy skies, it's 59 degrees at KJZZ. Fury over spiking water bills in Buckeye has drawn the attention of the Arizona Attorney General. As KJZZ's Matthew Casey reports from our West Valley Bureau, a letter sent to the city by the Consumer Information and Complaints Unit says state officials are working on a resolution.
In a letter sent to the city, the Attorney General's office included a homeowner's written complaint about Buckeye's billing practices. The resident had been a customer of Global Water Resources, a private company the city bought for $55 million. Buckeye took control of Global's infrastructure within the city limits last year, but an offshoot business still handles billing. The Attorney General's office told Buckeye that it's trying to resolve the issue with Global Water, and the letter was sent to the city so it can take any additional actions that are appropriate. An AG spokeswoman says she cannot comment on any potential ongoing investigations. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Arizona Corporation Commissioner Bob Burns has rejected a proposed settlement from APS. The deal would have ended Burns' dispute against the utility over its refusal to disclose spending in the 2014 election. Rachel Leingang has been covering this for the Arizona Capital Times, and she joins me. So, Rachel, what exactly was APS proposing here in the form of a new rule?
So, APS said, if you agree to stop your investigation into any of our previous spending, we'll agree to get this rule through that would make it so anybody who has business before the commission has to disclose anything they spend on commission elections. And it wouldn't just apply to regulated entities like APS or other utilities. It would apply to anybody with business before the commission, like solar companies. SolarCity has been very involved in election spending. But interveners span from really small water companies in rural Arizona to big corporations, like Walmart intervenes on some issues. So it would apply to anybody over there, which is many hundreds of companies.
But would not cover really the main question of what Commissioner Burns is trying to get to, which is spending in the 2014 election, right?
Exactly. And so that's why Burns rejected it. He said, I don't know what I could create a rule based on because I don't know what happened in the past. I don't know what's broken. How can I try to fix it? That was the crux of his opposition. And really, it was a digging in by APS of their position that they don't need to disclose anything from the past because they were doing everything legally. They followed all the applicable campaign finance rules. And Burns digging into his position that this is a stain on the commission. It's hurt its integrity, and it needs to be resolved before moving forward.
I would imagine that there's a disagreement about whether or not this was a good faith effort here by APS. I would assume that APS would say, look, we know this is a debate, we're trying to resolve it, and Commissioner Burns is saying maybe you're just trying to sweep what you did under the rug and pass this broad new rule to affect maybe what you're doing in the future.
Right. So Burns's lawyer called the rule illusory. He said it was a political dead letter, that no other people would agree to it because they'd be giving up a lot, and they don't even participate in elections, so they'd have to give up rights basically for nothing. And APS said, we agreed our rule that we're proposing here is way more than we're required to do by law, more than courts have said is necessary on campaign finance. And we were willing to help other people get on board as well. So APS thought they were giving a lot and not really getting anything out of it, while Burns thought that he was giving up basically everything he had tried to fight for.
So what now is the status of the current litigation? If Commissioner Burns is rejecting this settlement offer, where do we stand on the original suit here?
So that lawsuit's been on hold as there were attempts at settlement, and Burns told me yesterday that the letters from the lawyers here that were from November, beginning of November, basically. That was the last thing that happened. He's meeting with his lawyer to try to figure out what the next steps are. I would expect that, I mean, if the settlement talks stall, then the lawsuit will be reignited, is my expectation.
Rachel Leingang writes for the Arizona Capital Times. Rachel, thanks as always.
Thank you.
It's no secret Arizona has lots of potential when it comes to renewable energy, especially solar, but the state's current standards only require 15% of its energy come from renewables by 2025. That led the chair of Arizona's Public Utilities Commission to recently propose upping the target, but how to get there? There are different views on that, not to mention whether new standards are even necessary. KJZZ's Will Stone has been reporting on this and joins me. So, Will, okay, 15% by 2025 is the current goal. What could be the new target?
The new target mark being proposed is 30% by 2030, and that's coming from Doug Little, who's the chair of the Corporation Commission, and that's the regulatory agency that sets these renewable energy targets. The current one was set some years ago, and obviously clean energy has come a long way since then, especially the cost of solar energy. And this new target, many experts seem to agree, is pretty reasonable. Most neighboring states are in that neighborhood. Nevada, Colorado, Oregon all have standards that are about 25% or greater, and of course California is a leader with a 50% by 2030.
So what has been the response to this new proposed target?
It's mixed depending on who you're talking to, obviously. The commission just received comments this week from the major players. Those are the power companies, the solar industry, advocacy groups. The state's largest utility, Arizona Public Service, APS, does not think these new standards are really necessary. Here's Greg Bernoski, who's with the utility.
These technologies and the planning for them has matured to a point where mandates aren't what's driving more implementation. It's pricing, efficiency, and the opportunities that exist in the market.
Instead, APS would like the commission to let them use their own planning process, which Bernoski says is more flexible in what kind of energy can be included and could be more cost-effective. Now, that plan doesn't necessarily need approval from regulators, although they can give input. And APS just says, you know, the markets are already moving toward more renewables, so, you know, we don't need a prescriptive mandate.
Well, do proponents of renewables feel this way? I would imagine that they would say, great, let's do more.
Proponents of clean energy believe having a set target is important, that you shouldn't just leave this for the markets to decide. I spoke with Brianna Kobor, who's with the nonprofit Vote Solar, and she pushed back on that argument. This is what she said.
Having a requirement allows the commission a useful tool to check in on progress and examine if things are accelerating or decelerating and to consider other policy levers.
She actually believes the goal could be more ambitious than 30% by 2030, but for both the power companies and the clean energy industry, the question is really, how do we get there? Because not all renewables are the same, especially when it comes to solar.
Well, Will, what do you mean by that? You're saying some clean energy sources do or don't count?
Yeah, this is where it gets a bit wonky, but it also gets to the center of some of the fights and our disagreements over clean energy. Rooftop solar has grown massively. You know, there are more than 40,000 customers in APS territory alone, and that's a form of distributed energy generation. And the current standards require that 30% of the renewable energy added each year by utilities comes from distributed generation, things like rooftop solar. It was meant to encourage that industry. Now, the utilities have been fighting with the rooftop solar industry because they claim that rooftop solar has become a subsidy and it represents a cost shift. They believe this so-called carve-out for the rooftop solar industry that it exists currently is outdated and should be phased out or at least expanded. Sunrun, one of the major rooftop solar leasing companies, obviously wants it preserved. I spoke with Lon Huber, who's with the Residential Utility Consumer Office, which is a state agency that advocates for ratepayers. He says the carve-out needs to be looked out for several reasons.
If the reasons are to build an industry, I think for the most part we've done that. We've got some large rooftop solar companies. If it was to prove grid reliability, the goal was probably just too broad enough, focused enough.
And that issue of reliability that he mentioned at the end is really key because, you know, one of the major sources of contention in the debate between utilities and the solar industry over how to charge people with solar is that rooftop solar doesn't provide energy in the evenings when demand peaks and the utility really needs that energy. So Huber proposed having essentially a separate category, so one that doesn't just set a target for overall renewable energy in the state, but actually sets a target for how much is produced when that customer demand peaks. And that's kind of a new concept, and I'm sure will be part of the conversation as regulators look at these rules.
That's KJZZ's Will Stone. Will, thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
President-elect Donald Trump indicated for the first time on Thursday he supports completion of the Dakota Access Pipeline. Protesters have been camped out at the construction site in North Dakota for months, and now winter has arrived, dumping almost 2 feet of snow on the encampment this past week. The two-day deluge drove out some of the fair-weather protesters, but most are gearing up to stay. All are waiting to see what happens on Monday. That's the deadline set by the Army Corps of Engineers for protesters to leave federal land. For Inside Energy, Nikki Ouellette reports.
Kuze Ballou is hurrying to finish wrapping insulation around a wooden structure, like a little box house, at the Ocheti Shikoe camp near the Standing Rock Reservation.
It's essentially a glorified tent with a lot less chance of caving into snow.
Ballou is from Ohio. He's a member of the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi Indians.
That's about all people need out here, though, you know? I mean, it's like, I mean, we could go for comfort, but that's not why we're here, right?
Ballou is one of a few thousand people committed to this ongoing protest against the Dakota Access Pipeline. They're living in three camps along the banks of the Cannonball River, and that has authorities worried. The Ocheti Shikoe camp is the only one on federal land, where authorities say campers are illegally trespassing. The day after Thanksgiving, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers issued an emergency evacuation order for land it manages near the river. A few days later, North Dakota Governor Jack Dalrymple issued a similar order, warning that people trying to truck in supplies to the camp could be fined, and the state will no longer provide emergency services.
We will do our best to respond to emergencies, but under those conditions, we cannot guarantee a response.
Early reports of the evacuation order described it as a blockade. Dalrymple says that's not the case, but he still thinks people should leave for their own safety. He said this emergency order is the same he would issue during an intense flood.
We have not at any time ever contemplated going to the main camp and removing people from that area. All we're saying is that we encourage you to find a better place to be.
Some people did leave the camp after the storm and governor's order, but more are digging in for a long winter.
Knock, knock.
Come in.
Okay, thank you.
Paul Chioctin Wiggins designed and is building a new style of teepee for people preparing to stay and continue protesting the pipeline despite the pair of evacuation orders.
They have been endeared with the name Tarpee. They're kind of like unicorn teepees because they just have a stovepipe sticking out the top.
Wiggins is from the Saanich tribe in Washington State. He says he came up with the design after his first trip to Standing Rock in September.
And then I looked at the teepees and I was walking around. I was like, that's it. It's the structure. It's the perfect shape for the environment.
He started a GoFundMe site and raised enough money to build 80. They come equipped with a stove, fire extinguisher, and carbon monoxide detector. Closer to the Missouri River, Corrine Lewis is living in Michigan camp.
This is the kitchen.
She's part of the little band of Ottawa Indians and has been shuttling back and forth between the camp and her house in Michigan for a few months.
I felt like I was so at home and empowered to be here.
Michigan camp is a cluster of three army green canvas sleeping tents, a mess hall, a teepee filled with supplies, and a few tents half buried in snow. Currently, about 50 people live here. Lewis thinks they can make it without grocery runs for about a month. Even though she's living in the evacuation area, she says she has no plans to leave.
I'm pretty content here, but I don't want to leave. I want to stay here and I want to see what's going to happen.
Despite the orders to evacuate, more people are arriving every day, including a group of 2,000 veterans who say they plan to act as human shields between protesters and the police. For Inside Energy, I'm Nikki Ouellette in Cannonball, North Dakota.
Inside Energy is a collaboration of public radio stations reporting on energy issues. And here in Phoenix, some people are trying to help those protesters hunker down in the snow from more than 1,000 miles away. A Phoenix restaurant called The Coronado recently held a benefit for those at Standing Rock. Liam Murtaugh is the owner.
Usually we do like a little private Thanksgiving thing because of everything that's going on up there. We decided to cancel that, and then we decided to do something a little more proactive. The following night, 100% of our food sales went to Standing Rock.
Murtaugh also collected supplies to send up, but shortly after the event, detractors took to Facebook to give the restaurant negative reviews, including many who live out of state and have never been to the restaurant. In response to that, supporters both in and out of Arizona countered with the flood of positive reviews. Murtaugh says the whole thing was unexpected.
There's been so much positive and so many people caring about the issue that it's a little surprising that we got that negative feedback, but it's more overwhelming how many people actually care about this issue.
Other Phoenicians are trying to support the cause not with what they give to Standing Rock, but with what they bring back. A couple members of the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Phoenix visited protesters' camps this fall. In a meeting last night, they shared their trips through photos, music, and stories, hoping to paint a picture of what it's like out there. Elena Perez is of the Picarice Pueblo and Cochiti Pueblo tribes. She visited in September, camping right along the Cannonball River, and witnessed firsthand the dynamics between the groups staying there.
A lot of solidarity, a lot of pride, lots of cooperation, and lots of organic community creation.
She says what really struck her was the way organizers made a point to put indigenous voices first when making plans.
There was a person designated to mediate the time so that the non-indigenous voices didn't take up all the room. Because if you don't have that regulation, the tendency is that the indigenous or the minority will just sit back and the louder, more aggressive will just dominate the space.
She says it's a way to keep the Standing Rock Sioux's interests at the forefront as many non-indigenous supporters make the trek to North Dakota.
I have to go.
Jane Baker is a minister at Ascension Lutheran Church. She flies out on Monday.
Not wishing to bring to Standing Rock any answers. I don't fully understand the complexity of it, but I know that I have to stand with brothers and sisters of the world.
And she plans to talk to her congregation about the trip when she returns. When Arizonans passed Proposition 206 on Election Day, they voted to raise the minimum wage to $12 an hour by 2020. But a lesser-known provision of the ballot initiative will also allow domestic violence victims to take paid sick leave to deal with the violence. The show's Lauren Gilger joins me now with more on this. And Lauren, give us some details on this provision.
So Prop 206 allows full-time employees to take up to 5 paid sick days a year. And the language in the initiative really specifically allows workers to take time off for medical care, as well as taking care of a family member or for a public health emergency or to address domestic violence. So I spoke with Shannon Rich about this. She's the director of public policy at the Arizona Coalition to End Sexual Assault and Domestic Violence. And she told me, even though some employees might not feel comfortable telling their bosses that they need to take time off because they're a survivor of domestic violence, this provision still sends an important message to employees.
Having these policies will let survivors know that their employer, this is an issue that's important to them. They'll be able to see it in policy. This isn't just my sick time. This is also for me to be able to get safety. It also offers an opportunity for employers to start talking about domestic and sexual violence and really building up their policies to respond when someone that works for them is experiencing this at home. Because the numbers don't lie. 1 in 4 women and 1 in 7 men are going to experience domestic violence in their lifetime. So people are going to have employees working for their agencies that are experiencing this at home, and being able to have those policies built in will make survivors feel safe and opens that conversation with employers.
I want to talk a little bit about this link between economic security mm-hmm. and domestic violence. How do those two things come into play usually?
For most survivors, they may experience some form of economic abuse at home. They may not have access to financial resources. They may experience credit card debt or fraud that their abuser is doing for them. So being able to have a stable job and being able to have a job that pays well is a really important thing for survivors who are trying to find that economic stability. And then also having the ability to take time off work to address the needs that they may be experiencing through their abuse. So knowing that they don't have to make that choice between, am I going to be able to put food on the table today, or am I going to be able to go get services I need to be safe?
And you're not necessarily just talking about going to the doctor to treat a wound. You're talking about participating in prosecution court process?
Correct. Yeah, this isn't just about being able to access medical services. This is also about, I need to go to a counseling appointment because I want to talk about what's happening at home. Or I am in a place where I want to get an order of protection. I need to take time off of work to go do that. But for a lot of survivors, they have to make that choice between getting the order of protection and losing money because they've had to take an unpaid day off work.
So what does it mean that this provision made it into this legislation here in Arizona in the first place?
I think this is a great step for Arizona. It was a smaller piece of the proposition. A lot of people weren't talking about it, but this is a really big deal, particularly because it sends a message to survivors that their employers are going to be listening and they're now going to have this time that they can take off. And it is rare. Not a lot of states have passed this yet. What states have been doing is passing it on a city level. And so they've seen cities passing ordinances. But Arizona is definitely at the forefront of getting safe leave in place for survivors.
And how did this come about? Was it your organization?
This was a collaborative effort, so we definitely played a smaller role in this, but we've been talking about the issue of paid sick leave and safe leave for quite some time, both at the legislative level and looking at city ordinances here. And we've worked with great partners who just made sure that we could continue to talk about survivors in this process and that their voices weren't lost.
Obviously, like, the problem is the domestic abuse, not the sick time.
Right.
So is this sort of a Band-Aid for a bigger wound? Are there things that are forward-looking that you would like to change beyond this?
Right. So this is just a tool in someone's safety plan for getting to economic stability and getting to a place where they're not experiencing abuse anymore. This is just one step. This is certainly not a fix to everything. And a lot of what we would like to see, and again, it's starting with the minimum wage, people aren't making exactly a living wage in the state. So getting that first step is going to be great, particularly for survivors who are maybe working in lower paying jobs. But when they're trying to financially provide for themselves and find that kind of economic stability, it's hard to leave an abusive relationship when that person is also helping pay for housing and paying for food and helping to pay for children. So having things like affordable childcare, having affordable housing, having higher paying jobs that are available for survivors makes it easier to make that switch, to make that change, to find that safety while still being economically stable.
That was Shannon Rich, Director of Public Policy at the Arizona Coalition to End Sexual Assault and Domestic Violence. And she also said there's a lot that workplaces can do to respond to domestic and sexual violence. And we've posted a link to some of those resources on our website at theshow.kjzz.org.
That's the show's Lauren Gilger. Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you, Mark.
During the long presidential campaign, now President-elect Donald Trump's rhetoric was often harsh toward Muslims. He called for a ban on Muslims, and since winning the election, his transition team has floated the idea of a registry. KJZZ's Naomi Gingell joins me to talk about rising Islamophobia.
Hey, Mark. This negative rhetoric has had an impact on Muslims here in Arizona as well. And I spoke to the Council on American Islamic Relations, their Arizona chapter. CARE Arizona is a civil rights organization that also does advocacy. And I talked to both the executive director, Imran Siddiqui, and Christy Saba, who's the operations coordinator. So you'll hear both of them talking here. And Saba says, you know, being a woman who's Muslim, you tend to stick out more.
The sisters who wear hijab were kind of in the forefront of
the headscarf.
Right, exactly. The headscarf. We're kind of in the forefront of the Islamophobia because we stand out. We are, you know, noticeably Muslim. You know, there's a type of scrutiny that happens with us and that we always have to be vigilant and, you know, always going that extra mile, I would guess, you know, smiling and trying to counter that negative narrative that's always out there.
And I ask you, you both have children, and especially, Christy, you've got girls.
Yes.
I know that, like, after the election, there were conversations from Muslim women about whether or not they should take off their hijabs and whether or not, and I wonder if, like, this has something you've thought about or have had a conversation with your kids about or your friends or...
Absolutely. My oldest daughter is 13 and almost to the age where she should start putting the scarf on. And she has adamantly said that she is afraid to do so because of the platform that Trump has given with this anti-Muslim rhetoric. She knows that once that scarf goes on, she will be identified and singled out as a Muslim. Whereas right now she's not. She's just, you know, a kid. And so she has said that she's considering postponing putting that on just because she doesn't want to have that label on her back. In school, when the election happened the next day, her first period teacher, you know, said, are any of you kids fearful now? And she raised her hands and she said every Hispanic person in her classroom raised their hand. She was the only Muslim in her class, but she's like, it was me and all the Hispanics. We raised our hands saying that, yes, we are fearful of what's to come. So that's hard as a parent to hear that.
It's not just about the rhetoric that took place on the campaign trail or what's happening in society with a very sharp upswing in hate crimes. But then who is he bringing onto his transition team and cabinet? So we're seeing a lot of people from within what is deemed the Islamophobia industry actually being recommended as possible cabinet members.
And I guess what are like the ripple effects here in the Arizona area?
Right now, we haven't had an upswing in hate crimes as yet, thankfully. One thing we have to be cognizant of is that there is a gross lack of reporting on these issues. So the FBI just released their 2015 hate crime numbers, and they said that anti-Muslim hate crimes are up 2/3, like 67%. They say that the biggest problem that we're facing in terms of the Muslim community vis-a-vis hate crimes is the underreporting. The period that we're in right now is all about the undercurrent, what the psychic effects of what's happening out there. I mean, I have kids. I have a 10-year-old, 8-year-old, and 4-year-old. So even though we think the kids aren't as politically savvy as we think they are, they do talk about this stuff, and they know what the rhetoric is. And so I've heard my kids alluding, you know, oh, if Trump wins, you know, are they going to send us away? I'm like, no, this is not the case. You know, we're Americans. Nothing can be done. So I think that feeling is out there, and that's a normal feeling for people to have. But at the same time, we have to empower people. This is what the job of my organization is. I mean, you know, don't be scared. Don't stick your heads in the sand, because that's not going to help the situation. I mean, this can hopefully raise people up in activism there. And you may see a great rise in activism locally and nationally as well. And the thing is that we can take an example from the Latino community. Time that Sheriff Joe was up for re-election, they stood up, and there were losses in the beginning, but at the same time, they didn't retreat or stand back. They kept organizing, and the Latino community's activism came out positive in the end. So this may be sort of an uncertain or negative time, but I think in the long term, we will see positive results.
So can I say the Hate Hurts Project, so this is you've got specifically a website that mm-hmm. people are submitting hate crimes to?
Right. So there's a website. It's called hatehurts.net. So basically, we tell people if you are a victim of a hate crime, definitely report it to police first, and then, you know, contact a civil rights organization. And then, but this is basically a way of aggregating all of these crimes that are out there in the news but are just sort of floating under the radar. It's a combination of both. You have to address the negative stuff that's happening out there, but at the same time, there needs to be proactive, positive programs to get people involved.
Imran Siddiqui from CARE Arizona also says that multiple community groups have reached out to them to offer support and also to want to work with them. So he and Chrissy Sabah have a positive, pretty resilient outlook.
And that's the KJZZ's Naomi Gingold. Thanks, Naomi.
Thanks, Mark.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. In a check of international news, on Sunday, for the second time this year, Austrians will vote to choose their new president. It's a mainly ceremonial role, but the election has polarized the country. A candidate from the far-right Freedom Party hopes to become the first far-right head of state in the EU. An election held earlier this year was annulled by the country's high court because of irregularities in the way the mail-in votes were counted. The latest polls say the vote now is too close to call. The BBC's Bethany Bell reports.
ATV Meine Wahl, das Duell. Alexander van der Bellen und Norbert Hofer, live.
Another day, another TV debate. Presidential elections are normally quiet affairs in Austria, but not this one. The main centre-left and right parties were knocked out of the race in the spring. Then the vote in May was overturned by the High Court, and a rerun, planned for October, had to be postponed because of problems with the glue on postal votes. And then there are the candidates.
Vertrauen. Geborgenheit.
Norbert Hofer of the far-right anti-immigrant Freedom Party, who wants a referendum on Austria's EU membership if the EU becomes more centralised after Brexit.
I am from Austria.
And there's his pro-European rival, Alexander van der Bellen, who says he wants a liberal, cosmopolitan Austria. The political analyst, Thomas Hofer, no relation, says the country is deeply split.
The country is absolutely polarized. You can see this not only ideological, but fundamental split when it comes, for example, to the attitude towards the European Union. Is it a good idea to be within this union, yes or no? Or, concerning refugees, is it a good thing to help them or not?
At a Christmas market in the southern town of Klagenfurt, I caught up with Norbert Hofer as he campaigned among revelers drinking hot mulled wine. Many Austrians say he's racist, anti-Muslim and xenophobic. But he denies that.
I'm not a right-wing man. I'm a middle-right man. I don't think that people are really afraid. They are not, because they know me now since a couple of months, you know.
This has been a long year of campaigning. Do you think you have a better chance now?
I think so, yes. It's something I feel when I'm on my tour through Austria. The people, they are very friendly. They are talking about safety, about their jobs, unemployment. They are very open-minded, and there's a lot of hope there.
Ein Gespenst geht in Europa. Das Gespenst des Nationalismus.
This campaign video says no to Exit, no to Austria leaving the EU. It was financed by one of Austria's top businessmen, Hans-Peter Haselsteiner.
Mr. Hofer is a declared anti-European and right-wing populist. I think it's high time to contradict and to say we do not want this. This anti-European thing is dangerous for our economy. And besides this, I do not think they have any answers on the big challenges of our society.
At another Christmas market, I met Alexander van der Bellen on the campaign trail. He says that if he wins, it will be a sign that the populist trend that brought the world Brexit and Trump could be stopped.
Yes, I'm very confident, but I'm not sure that I'll be winning. It depends very much whether people will vote on the 4th of December.
That was the BBC's Bethany Bell in Vienna.
Rhodes Scholarships have been awarded by Oxford since 1903. The recipients have included David Souter in 1963, Bill Clinton in 1968, Bobby Jindal in 1994, and Rachel Maddow in 2001. Late last month, the 2017 class was announced, and one of the 32 Americans chosen is Valley resident Oscar De Los Santos, who is the only Latino scholar in the class. So, Oscar, how excited, how honored were you to be named a Rhodes Scholar?
You know, I had mixed thoughts. I was obviously very excited, but at the same time, I was disappointed because I knew that I was the only Latino Rhodes Scholar for this year in the entire country, and that was very disappointing. It's an impressive scholarship. It's sort of a funnel to leadership positions, and I was disappointed that powerful institutions continue to sort of marginalize and underestimate the talent and the value of the work of people of color.
Many folks are thinking that from a generational standpoint, as the generations get older, it is up to the younger generations to try to change what they think may be wrong or that can be improved in our society. In general, are you aimed at that? And more specifically, where will your studies take you as far as that goes?
Absolutely. I think that my focus will be on changing public policy in a way that allows not just vulnerable people and marginalized people to climb the proverbial ladder of opportunity, but to tear down the barriers that are keeping them down in the first place. That is sort of the vision, as it were. But I'll be studying public policy and I'll be studying Christian ethics at Oxford. And I've picked those two degrees because I think that the big issues we face, poverty, mass incarceration, mass deportation, the rest of it, they're not just technical issues in search of 10-point plans or policy solutions. They're also the result of, I think, our callousness as a society. Before we can arrive at policy solutions, we've got to have a sort of conversation with ourselves about what our morals are.
And the changes you'd like to see as it relates to marginalized communities, do you think those changes come about or can come about more at a grassroots level? Or is that up to young folks like yourself getting more involved in government, for example?
I think it's a both and solution. I don't think that one is necessarily more important or can do it by itself. I think that, you know, we've seen dreamers march in the streets. We've seen folks involved in Black Lives Matter who've gotten this issue into the public agenda. But, you know, obviously the fact is that if you want to change policy, you need votes. And so it's a political ecosystem. It's not a silo. And you can't make change in just one area. You've got to work in sort of all aspects of the ecosystem.
How eager are you to jump in and be even more involved in trying to bring about change? And I ask it because I think there can be some, I think we all fall victim to this occasionally, to be discouraged by certain events that make us unhappy. Is that the sort of thing that makes you even more enthusiastic about getting in and trying to see change happen?
It's not just a matter of enthusiasm. It's also, for a lot of communities, a matter of survival. It's an imperative to get involved. So not to downplay the severity of the challenges that we'll be facing, but now is obviously not the time to quit.
Levine resident Oscar De Los Santos. He is one of 32 Americans chosen to be a 2017 Rhodes Scholar.
One of the most iconic buildings on ASU's Tempe campus is getting ready for a makeover. The university plans to renovate Hayden Library, which sees, on average, more than 1.5 million visitors each year. Jim O'Donnell is the university librarian at ASU and joins me to talk about this project. So, Jim, what's the plan for Hayden Library?
What I told the architects when we began talking about this is that we really need architects. We really need to fix up the building. It's a tired old building with good bones. But it's not about the building. Your library now is everywhere. And the building in which we keep the books and other facilities and services is a very different place as a result. So we want to invent and imagine the central library building when it's not the center of the universe anymore, but a hub for people, a hub for services, a hub for books, a hub for opportunity for all the students and faculty of ASU.
So what does that look like then, and how is that different from how Hayden Library has traditionally been since it was built in the 60s?
Traditional library building was built to have as many places to put things as possible and squeeze as many things in as you can. We now have off-site high-density shelving, climate-controlled, perfect preservation conditions, and we will be supplying most of the physical books to all of our campuses and all of our online students around the world from that, you could call it, fulfillment center on our Poly campus.
Kind of like Amazon or something.
Exactly. The main campus buildings will certainly have books. The books aren't going away, but there will be fewer of them. They will be presented, I think, better and more usefully than they have been in the past. But we will also have workspaces for our students, both private workspaces, quiet workspaces, and group workspaces. We also certainly expect to feature our special collections. In the future world of libraries, the things you possess will all be special, and the data you're accessing from someplace else will be commodity data that everybody else in the world is accessing.
What percentage of what is now in Hayden Library is available digitally? If you're moving books and other sort of physical research-type materials off-site potentially, is a lot of that stuff available otherwise to students?
Well, that's a good question. Most of the scholarly periodicals that people depend on, in many disciplines, the periodicals, the journals, are what you depend on. Most of those are approaching 100% accessible. Traditional books and monographs, nowhere near enough has been digitized.
So are you concerned then that students who would want that kind of information might have a harder time getting access to it if it's not available digitally?
So what we do to compensate is work very hard on what we now call discovery tools. Think of Amazon search inside the book. You can't leaf through the book before you buy it from Amazon, but that search inside the book gets you a proxy, gets you going. That's not available for everything, but it's available for more things than used to be the case. But there's other ways in which we can develop online browsing tools that give you, in some ways, a better experience, only in some ways, but in some ways, a better experience of browsing than you have on the traditional shelves. If we give you an electronic browsing shelf, nothing is checked out. You can see all the books. That's an improvement.
How will students be impacted during the construction? This is a multi-year project you guys are undertaking.
Fingers crossed. We think, hope, and expect we will close the 1966 tower in the summer of 17. Our underground extension, built in 1989, will remain open. Noble Library, the science library three blocks away, will remain open. Our physical facilities on other campuses will remain open. And we'll be able to deliver stuff to you as much as we can. The other thing we're doing is we know that there are a lot of students who use Hayden as a quiet, safe, convenient working space who aren't using the library collections. We're working with campus leadership to make sure that we're providing enough seats elsewhere on campus so that when exam period comes, those 15,000 students have a place to go.
Would you say that what you're doing at Hayden Library sort of falls in line with the trend that we're seeing at other university libraries and to an extent other public libraries where sort of the role and the use of a library is evolving?
The exciting part of being in this profession at this time is reimagining what we do when you come into the building to give you the maximum opportunity to pursue the questions you already want to know the answers to, help you find other questions, and help you find material for answering those questions that you never dreamed of before. We've been talking a little bit about what we call inquiry entrepreneurship. We say that for two reasons. One is that in the modern university, you get extra points every time you say the word entrepreneurship, and that's important. But it's also the case that it's a true expression of what you do in a library. Think of your question as a startup business. You've got a question, it's kind of coming into shape, you think you can get the answer to it, but you need an incubator. You need a startup place where there are wizards who can help you with the hard part of getting started. Librarians I've compared to Jedi Knights, those are the wizards who can help you find the tools you need, figure out how to use them, go away, use them for a while, come back and get some more help.
Jim O'Donnell is the university librarian at ASU. Jim, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Been a pleasure to be here.
In the running world, there are marathoners, and then there are ultra runners. That means people who run races longer than the 26.2 miles of a marathon. They run 50K races, 100 milers, trail races, and from rim to rim across the Grand Canyon. And now a Prescott man has completed a record-breaking run of the Arizona Trail. The show's Lauren Gilger recently spoke with him about this, and she joins me. So, Lauren, exactly how long is the Arizona Trail?
So the Arizona Trail runs from the border of Utah up in northern Arizona all the way to our southern border with Mexico.
Wow.
And it's not a straight line, right? It's kind of winds its way through the state, including through the Grand Canyon, by the way. So in all, it's about 800 miles long. And Michael Versteeg ran the whole thing. He had a crew driving alongside him up ahead, basically making sure that he had food and a place to sleep throughout the run. And he's the first person to ever even attempt a run like this of the Arizona Trail. So when I talked to him, I really wanted to know why ultra running? Why 800 miles?
I think a lot of ultra runners and trail runners in general don't necessarily come from a fitness background or care really about the number of miles or the number of calories that they're burning. It comes from more of a spot that is they just like being outside and they just like being in the mountains for hours on end. And so when you do that, when you run in the mountains for 5-6 hours on a Saturday or something, you just happen to run that far because you're out there for a long time.
Right. So tell us, what is the Arizona Trail?
The Arizona Trail is extremely diverse in the sense that you run through high elevation, low elevation. You run through almost every environment that there is. You're up in, say, North Rim, you're up above 9,000 feet and running in near alpine or subalpine environments. And then you get to the montane forest of, you know, Doug fir and spruce. And all of a sudden you drop down and you're in upper and lower Sonoran Desert. And you do that throughout the entire run. And like the southern section of the trail, you run up these sky islands and you find yourself where just a few hours before you were in cactus and Sonoran Desert, you find yourself in montane forests almost like Colorado.
So how long did this take you altogether?
I finished just about an hour and a half under 16 days, which was actually my goal from day one.
What does it average out to then, mileage-wise per day?
So that really was the goal for me. My goal was to keep the average above 50 miles a day.
So that sounds like just inexplicable to me, and probably to a lot of people. So how do you explain that to people, that drive that you had to do that, to run 50 miles a day for 16 days?
Yeah, I don't actually know. You basically have to be the most unwaveringly stubborn person ever. Even crew, even my friends who were there, everyone who was there wanted me to rest more. And I can't explain really what it was. Like, after a week of doing this, you're so invested and you're so dedicated and you're so consumed with the idea that if anyone would hint at anything else, it would just do the opposite. And maybe, I don't know, maybe now that I think about it, maybe my crew was doing that on purpose because they knew that it would do that.
So tell me what that was like when you were approaching the finish line, when you knew you were close. What did that feel like to finish it?
I was so tired and I was so exhausted that it wasn't really the grandest moment. It wasn't that kind of, you know, storybook emotional ending to a movie where you get there and everyone starts crying and hugging each other, and, you know. But I finished at about 4:30 in the morning, so the sun had not come up yet, and I was really dedicated to seeing the finish in Mexico with the sun coming up. So I actually had about 5 people there who were part of my crew at that time, so I woke everybody up, and we all went down to the border together. And we got there in the dark, you know, and we all gave each other hugs and congratulated each other. And then I actually made them hike in burritos and coffee and a little bit of whiskey. And we actually sat there and fell asleep for half an hour and then watched the sunrise. And that was really amazing. That was more special to me than the actual moment when I finished, because it was really starting to sink in what I had done over the previous 16 days. And you know, when you put yourself through something as honestly torturous as it was at times, and difficult and painful, both, you know, emotionally and physically, when you complete something like that, those things don't go away. But what also comes with that is a sense of satisfaction and accomplishment that is really, I haven't been able to compare it to anything else. And I would say that honestly, finishing the Arizona Trail and hitting my goals is, even with all the things I've done in the past with the 100-milers and racing and blah, 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 I can honestly say that this is, without too much ego, that this is like the first thing that I'm really proud of that I've done. And I don't feel like I need to clarify that with any sort of statement. I can just appreciate that. And that's actually pretty rare for me. And that makes me really happy.
It sounds like you have a lot to be proud of. Michael Versteeg, thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Yeah, thank you so much for your time.
That was Michael Versteeg, the Prescott man who recently became the fastest person to ever run the Arizona Trail.
And that's the show's Lauren Gilger. Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you, Mark.
When you think of famous bands that have come out of the Phoenix area, the Gin Blossoms and Jimmy Eat World might spring to mind, but you might not have heard of one of the Valley's most enduring musical acts, which has been going nonstop for decades. KJZZ's Stina Sieg takes a trip to the East Valley to meet one of the oldest, but also youngest, bands around.
Every Tuesday and Thursday afternoon, this is Annie Beach's living room in Chandler. That's about 24 children from kindergarten to high school strumming guitars and bowing violins. A few little girls are plucking canjos. Those are banjos made with one string and a soda can. And always, there's Beach, leading the whole thing.
I mean, it's fantastic. I can understand every single word you guys are saying. And I can't say that about a lot of professionals.
Miss Beach, as the kids call her, has long white braids and black, thick-rimmed glasses. The 73-year-old is tiny, far shorter than many of the kids here, but she commands a big presence. She has to. She's been running Jam Pack Blues and Grass Neighborhood Band since 1994.
We stick out. You know, we stick out in the bluegrass world especially.
That's because bluegrass, folk music that originated out in Appalachia, is known for being lily white. But Beach's band is a kaleidoscope of colors and includes kids from all backgrounds and economic situations. No one pays anything to be here, and everyone is welcome. It's been that way since the very beginning, when, 22 years ago, 2 little boys appeared on Beach's doorstep. She had just substituted for their second-grade class and, like always, had brought along her mandolin.
And knock, knock, knock. And they said, can we play some more music?
Oh, I love those seals of old.
Within a short time, Beach had 17 young, eager players. And then the thing kept gaining momentum and students. These days, Jam Pack wins awards and plays all over the state. Once total outsiders, they've become this force in the bluegrass world. About 200 kids have gone through Jam Pack so far, and many are second generation. Like Selena Haggerty, a 15-year-old mandolin player whose mom, aunt, and uncle were all in the band. Haggerty says she feels lucky to be here.
Yeah, I really do. I feel super, like, privileged, and I don't know, I feel like it makes me proud, like, to know that I'm here and I do this.
This is not just about making music, but about making a tight-knit community, one that very few players ever really leave, even when they grow up. Tons of Jam Pack alums stick around, maybe teaching the younger kids or spinning off into new bands. 13-year-old Alazia Zawaldi, who plays an old-time stringed instrument called the Mountain Dulcimer, describes the Jam Pack culture like this.
Coming together to play music and becoming one despite anything, despite, you know, the differences that we all have, we all come together to form this beautiful thing.
And is there a secret to forming that beauty?
Oh, boy.
Annie Beach smiles and sighs when I ask her.
There's a great deal of love goes into it. Even if I get mad, anything, I love every single person that's part of this.
Miss Beach thinks someday one of those people will take up the responsibility of Jam Pack and keep it going long after she's gone. Right now, she's the one who drives many of the kids to and from practice, who cooks them dinner every night they're here. She makes them all photo albums and hosts birthday parties. It's a lot of work, she says, but it's no sacrifice. It's how she wants to spend the rest of her life.
And I say I want a pure heart and I want a pure focus from here until you guys are singing me out.
Jam Pack's next big gig is the Tempe Festival of the Arts, today through Sunday. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, reporting from Chandler.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.